The poor and the middle class mindset is completely wrong about money. They work to make money to pay. We have a lot of pseudoscience out there, right? So we have a lot of...
You're talking about the opposite of what the mainstream media is talking about, right? They're saying, you know, everything's doom and gloom, Trump's doing these tariffs. It seems like they're sounding the alarm bells.
I think that's number one. I think number two, we have David Bailey's company, Nakamoto, $700 million raised in 5 days, meaning 5 days to do our due diligence, decide if we want to be in or out. Vivek Ramaswamy just launched one called Asset. They gave us $48. What this shows to me is
a new phenomenon is also like individuals utilizing their Bitcoin to loan against that.
Yeah, 100% they should. Basically, here's the format. All that proof of work of their life, gone up in smoke. They're gobbling up a lot of Bitcoin. And ultimately what I'd say is,
what's up, y'all? I've realized over 50,000 of you guys keep coming back and listening to every single episode. And while I'm eternally grateful that you guys keep coming and listening to every episode, I've realized that over 79% of you guys are not subscribed. So I've got one small ask for you guys. If you can hit that subscribe button and that like button wherever you're tuning in, it'll help catch the algorithm and help orange pill the masses. Now, I'm eternally grateful for you guys to keep following along and listening in. So thank you guys all so much for joining in on this journey. Now, let's get into another great episode. Bing bong. We are back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I've got the man, the myth, the legend, yeah, Mark Moss in the house. Mark, you had a really interesting video the other day, actually, that I want to dive into about the 5-year Bitcoin retirement strategy.
Yep.
So that's an extremely popular topic on, and controversial topic for that matter, on YouTube. So tell me a little bit about that. And yeah, how much Bitcoin do you think we need to retire?
Thank you. Thanks for bringing that up. And we didn't talk about that topic before we started recording, but it's my favorite topic. It's my favorite topic because it's... one of my biggest gripes with mainstream school, mainstream thought, and we're sort of been, a lot of people are not, most people are not equipped for the world that we're in today. We were trained in an industrial school era, given a set of industrial era tools, but we're no longer in that world today. And so we were raised in this, go to school, get good grades, get a good job, save for retirement 30 to 40 years, and then maybe you'll have enough money to live off of that. And I think that is the exact opposite. Like most things we're taught, the exact opposite of what we should do. And I think it's terrible advice for many reasons. Number one, it doesn't work. Half of baby boomers today have no savings. So it just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. The half that do have savings of in the United States is an average of about $240,000. Now, what they've been trained to do is save for 40 years, delay gratification, and then they can quit and do nothing, live a life of leisure, and live off their savings, and hopefully it doesn't run out before they die. And then they leave the world with nothing. All that proof of work of their life gone up in smoke. And I think that's a very fiat mindset, right? As a Bitcoiner, I believe that our life should be proof of work. And I should build something. I should have a block for my life that my kids could build on top of. And why wouldn't I want the future generations to have a higher leg up than I started with? And so the thought of, like I said, spending down my savings and hopefully die before I run out of money just seems terrible. On top of that, mainstream economics would tell you, like Dave Ramsey would tell you, that, well, you could sell 4% of your stock, you know, and hopefully that works. Not if you retired in, you know, 2008, it wouldn't work. Or one of these periods in the year 2000, for example, it took 15 years to get back to even. So it's terrible advice. For all those reasons. One, it doesn't work. Like I said, number two, like I said, if you had that $240,000, which is the average of savings, at a 4% spend down, which is what Dave Ramsey would recommend, that's about $800 a month. Now, you were saying you were in Colombia. Maybe you can live there for $800 a month.
Yeah.
Most of the world, you can't, right? So it's just terrible advice altogether. Now, we have the first new financial asset we've had in over 500 years, Bitcoin. And we try to understand it. It's sort of like this. It's sort of like this. And it is sort of like those things, but it's something different. And with it, we can do things that we couldn't do before. We have a new set of building blocks. Now, one of those things is we can take traditional, or I should say elite level financial strategies that were only available to the 1%, and now they're accessible to everybody. And so Bitcoin enables us, back to the question, the topic, the video, we can build out a 5-year retirement plan. At least that's what I proposed in the video. You want me to break down how that works?
Yeah, sure. If you want to go into it just a little bit, like top to start. You don't have to give all away the secret sauce.
I want to give it away. I've done several videos on this. We've gotten millions of views on this. I wrote a book. It's like a 10,000-word book on how to break it down. I have a free calculator. I want everyone to tap into this. I'm going to rewrite it and turn it into a book called The 5-Year Retirement. But basically, here's the format. The poor and the middle class mindset is completely wrong about money. As a matter of fact, Eric Kaysen had put something on X the other day, which is basically the same thing I say. And he said that forget trying to orange pill the masses will never get it. I'm paraphrasing what he said. And the reason why the masses will never get it is because they don't understand money or value, right? And so I say the same thing. Most people can't understand Bitcoin. They don't understand money, which seems ridiculous because we all use money. But here's the thing. The poor and the middle class think about money, the relationship with money, the way they earn money, the reason they earn money, and how they save money completely different than the wealthy do. Now, most people are not going to like this advice or say that's not true. Well, you don't know a lot of billionaires. So the poor and the middle class, they work to make money to pay for their bills. The middle class has a little bit of a higher standard of living than the poor. And this is a mindset. It's not about how much money you make. So I'm working to pay my bills. I need to make more money so I can pay more bills. I can have a bigger house. I can have a bigger car. That's their relationship. That's the way they view it. The way they use credit, this is a key piece here. The way they use credit is to buy things they can't afford. Now the poor, they can't even afford to live, so they're augmenting their life. But the middle class use it to get the bigger house, the bigger car, go on vacation. Now let's contrast that with the way the wealthy think about this. This is a very key piece. The wealthy work not to pay for their life or pay for the bills. They work to buy, they use their money they earn to buy assets. And then they use the assets to pay for their life. So there's a step in between there. And the second step is the way they use credit is completely different. They use, you've probably all seen this before. You know somebody who's very wealthy and they use credit to buy something. You're like, why would you use credit to buy that? Don't you have the money for that? Yes, but it's because that's a poor mentality. We're using credit to buy things we can't afford. The wealthy use credit because it's cheaper than using their own money. It's cheaper to use someone else's money than their own. All right, so that's the key differentiation. So what does that mean? How does that even work? People can't wrap their head around that. So what we want to do is we want to earn money and buy assets. And we take that earned money, which is taxed at the highest rate, no matter what country you're in the world, and we want to be able to reduce the taxes off of that. We can get more into that later. And I put that into assets. And then as those assets go up in value, I leverage the assets with debt. And I use the money I've pulled out from debt then to pay my expenses. Now, most people would say, isn't that risky? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that risky? That's because you have a poor mentality. You see, the poor mentality views credit as something you only use to get things you can't afford. The wealthy can afford it. They have the money. They have the assets. They leverage it with debt for two reasons. Number one, when I pull debt against an asset, I don't pay tax on that income. Tax is the number one wealth killer that we have. Number two, if I sell the asset, I pay tax, and I no longer have the asset going up in value. So if I keep the asset going up in value and lever it with debt, then I have income with no taxes. And the last thing I'll say is, so now that has only been available to billionaires. They're the only ones that had enough assets to be able to really do this. But Bitcoin has changed that because we now have an asset going up about 50% a year. And as long as the asset is going up faster than the rate of debt we're accumulating, we can essentially do that forever.
Now, it's really interesting that you're kind of like talking about these traditional financial tools. We talked a little bit pre-show about how businesses are starting to do that. But a new phenomenon is also like individuals utilizing their Bitcoin to loan against that. You've talked a lot about real estate and a lot of the tax advantages on that. I'm curious your view on potentially taking out a loan against your Bitcoin to potentially buy other assets like real estate. Do you see that as maybe a new wave of like these hodled, you know, millionaires or however much Bitcoin that they have? That they're going to utilize that Bitcoin as, you know, collateral in order to buy real estate, potentially another cash flowing asset or something along those lines?
Yeah, 100% they should, but not maybe in just a general way, a very specific way. Robert Kiyosaki in his book, Rich Dad Poor Dad, talked about good debt versus bad debt. So bad debt is non-productive debt. That's paying on my credit card to go on vacation. Good debt is debt that is earning, right? So if I take out a 5% 30-year fixed loan, which we get in America, on a property that's earning 10% a year, that's good, right? So it's earning more. So what we would want to take out debt that pays more, earns more than what we're paying. So for example, if I borrow against my Bitcoin at 15%, I don't know if I'd want to buy a piece of rental property that's earning 5%, for example. Mm-hmm. That'd be reverse arbitrage. The way that I think about it is, number one, taking debt to buy assets that earn me more, number one. But also, the wealthy think about assets a little bit differently. So most wealthy are not buying apartments for the cash flow. A lot of times they're buying it for the tax depreciation. So there's things we could do. So for example, I could lever, let's say hypothetically I had $100,000, I wanted to buy one Bitcoin. I could also buy $100,000 worth of mining equipment, Bitcoin mining equipment, and over 2.5 years earn 2 Bitcoin. Now, if I'm going to hold the Bitcoin for a couple years, would I rather have 2 or 1? Yeah. 2 sounds pretty good. Mm-hmm. So I could borrow $100,000 from my Bitcoin, buy $100,000 worth of mining equipment. Now I could write off the $100,000 of income I just made at a 35% tax bracket. I just put $35,000 back into my pocket. Now, over 2 years, 2.5 years, I have twice the amount of Bitcoin if I would have paid cash, plus I'm up to $35,000 I would have given to Uncle Sam, and I get to keep that myself.
Interesting. Yeah, I never really thought about potentially utilizing that to buy Bitcoin miners. The one thing that kind of pops in my head is that, you know, last cycle, we did see that boom and bust with a lot of these Bitcoin miners who essentially were almost taking out loans against the mining equipment. Now, what is the difference you see with potentially, you know, doing something on that's like guaranteed to depreciate, like a Bitcoin miner, right? Because of the hashing power, all of the intricacies of Bitcoin mining, opposed to taking the loan and getting the collateral based on Bitcoin. Is there just a bigger difference because, you know, Bitcoin is a better collateral asset than the guaranteed depreciation of the Bitcoin miners?
So first of all, we're talking about broad strategies,
yeah,
and that is taking earned income and buying assets, mm-hmm, and using assets to then pay for my life. So if I want to, because I want to take that earned income, buy assets, but I don't want to pay tax on that earned income.
Yeah. Okay.
So I have to buy a capital asset that can be depreciated. Now that could be real estate.
Okay.
It could be cars. Yeah. It could be equipment for my business. It could be lots of things. In this instance, I was just talking, since we're on a Bitcoin podcast, buying Bitcoin miners. But to answer, so it could be anything. So I could buy a piece of real estate. In the U.S., we can do accelerated depreciation against that. Trump is reinstating that through his beautiful tax bill, big, beautiful bill. And so I could take that accelerated depreciation. So I could do it on real estate. But back to the Bitcoin piece. So there's a couple things. Number one, we are talking about a lot of publicly traded Bitcoin companies that got in trouble. Mm-hmm. Public Bitcoin companies are much different than you and I. Let's say if I was going through a self-hosted mining platform like Blockware, for example. So, you know, for example, like Riot, paying himself, what do you pay him? $18 million salary, right? Mm-hmm. Mara mining all kinds of things other than Bitcoin. So they're doing a lot of things that you and I wouldn't do with a self-hosted mining. Number one. Back to number two, as far as the debt, well, again, the debt is buying things that we can afford. So you said, what about it depreciating over 4 or 5 years, I think is what you, mm-hmm, stated. That's the whole point.
Gotcha.
We want the depreciation. So yes, they depreciate, and that's the whole point. That's why we get that write-off. So Bitcoin miners are good for about 4 or 5 years. We depreciate them over 4 or 5 years. We take all that up in year one. We write it till the end of its lifespan, and then we get rid of it and we do it again.
Okay, there we go. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
Okay, so now I understand kind of where you were coming from with that. But, you know, we talked about some of the publicly traded miners. I want to talk more about the corporations. That's the FOMO that we're starting to see, right? Like, it seems like every single day, some random company is raising billions of dollars to buy Bitcoin. I think we even had a coffee company do that recently, yeah, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah.
So what do you think of just this new corporate wave of putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet?
I think it's exciting. I think it's, as a matter of fact, here we are in Prague. I'm going to give a keynote talking about this topic specifically and talking about how we're in the age of infinite efficiency because of AI and how it meets absolute scarcity, which is Bitcoin. So we'll be talking a lot about that. But I think if you look at these types of companies that are doing it right now, so we obviously have MicroStrategy, which has pioneered this, Metaplanet, sort of that second mover advantage. But now they're popping up left and right, to your point. We've probably seen, you know, a dozen or 15 of them in the last month. The way that I'm looking at it is a couple of different ways. Number one, if you look at MicroStrategy, they used to be a software company. Today, their product is no longer software. I mean, they still sell it, but their main product is their stock, MSTR. Then they came out with another one, STRK, and another one, STRF, and another one they just came out with, STRV, now Strive, I think it is, right? It's happening so fast, you can barely keep up. And so those are the products they're bringing to market. Now, you might ask yourself, well, how many financial markets can the market bear? Thousands, tens of thousands. You can almost look at them like an ETF. So an ETF is a basket that anyone could launch their own ETF and you can come up with whatever basket you want to be in there. And you'd almost think that each one of these is sort of like an ETF. Each one has a little bit of a different business model, a little bit of a different treasury strategy. And how many ETFs are there? Again, thousands and thousands. So I think there's a lot that can be that can be in the market. I think the market can bear a lot. And I think it's the future of companies. Again, sort of back to the statement of the first financial asset, new financial asset in 500 years. And we're just trying to figure out all the different things we can build with it. I think it's exciting. And I think obviously there's a lot of money being made here. They're gobbling up a lot of Bitcoin. And ultimately what I'd say is, just as a couple days ago, Circle, the second largest stablecoin out there, did an IPO. Mm-hmm. It was 25% oversubscribed. My fund, I'm a partner in, the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, we tried to get in there and we couldn't even get into it. We have David Bailey's company, Nakamoto, kindly Nakamoto, $700 million raised in 5 days, a pipe, meaning us as a fund had 5 days to do our due diligence, decide if we want to be in or out. Vivek Ramaswamy just launched one called Asset. They gave us 48 hours.
That's crazy.
And so what this shows to me is that there is way more money than most people can realize sitting on the sidelines, ready to get into Bitcoin, but not quite sure how, or their mandates don't allow them to. So it's extremely bullish.
All right. Well, yeah, I mean, that gets me fired up just hearing about all that. But is there a worry about those timelines? Because I don't know how long that it's normal for, you know, these companies to raise this kind of money, but it seems like 48 hours or 5 days is a, you know, a short period of time, but they're raising, you know, millions of dollars. Is there some sort of, I guess, worry here where maybe some of these corporations are getting sold at way above their premium and everything else? And then, you know, maybe they'll just get closer to that one-to-one post IPO. Is there kind of that worry for, you know, somebody that's looking and evaluating some of these companies?
Certainly there's a big worry in that. And so there's a whole new set of metrics when you're looking at treasury companies that we don't have in traditional finance. And so we're looking at, you know, MNAV, right? We're looking at Bitcoin per share. And really, I think what you asked is maybe the leverage, right? So like, why is MicroStrategy trading at a 1.9 times MNAV, whereas maybe Metaplanet's at a 6 or 7 times MNAV, or maybe a new one that just came out might be a 9 or a 10. And it really comes down to how long we think, Adam Back came up with the metric of days to cover. Like, how long will it take them to add enough Bitcoin in order to cover that multiple? But ultimately, I would sort of look at that when you're asking about risk, sort of like a traditional stock, you look at like a PE ratio. Mm-hmm. So why is Tesla trading at 140 or 150 times PE ratio versus the Mag 7 or somewhere in the 30 to 50 range? But why 30 to 50? Why 45? Why not 48? Why not 52? Why not 39? You know what I mean? And so that PE ratio can change, and sort of that MNAV can sort of change as well. But that's definitely a risk, right? You buy it at 6 and it compresses down to a 1. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you see the share price drop. So I think there's a risk in that, and that's the equity game if people want to play that, right? For most of us Bitcoiners, one Bitcoin's worth one Bitcoin, and so we don't really have to play that game. We're sidestepping that. I think this is a way that, you know, if you want to get that extra volatility, which is what, you know, MicroStrategy brought to the market, there's certainly a way to play that. Now, how do we mitigate that risk? Most of these companies, because now they're publicly traded, are forecasting out what their plans are to grow that. And so that's where you start to see these aggressive buy plans. So like MicroStrategy has sort of laid out their long-term plan. Metaplanet has laid out their long-term plan. We have a new one that just launched in the UK called the Smart Web Company, and they've laid out like a 10-year plan. And so, yeah, the risk is they don't fulfill that.
I gotcha. Okay, that's interesting. So I've got kind of like a two-part question here. One is just based on, you know, the traditional metrics of evaluating stocks. Do you think traditional finance has essentially gotten there yet? And then the other part of the question is, you know, Wells Fargo's actually come out and said that Bitcoin is starting to dip into the bond market. And do you see that kind of as a shift potentially for like TradFi to, you know, instead of looking at the 60-40 portfolio, maybe it's a 60-30 with like 10% towards Bitcoin or something like that. Do you see that as more of a shift as well?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we have a $300 trillion bond market mm-hmm. that's going to get gobbled up for sure. We're already starting to see this. So not only that, we have the fixed income market, which is probably the biggest market in the world. And so that's sort of where MicroStrategy with their Strike and their Strife is going after the fixed income market. So if you're an allocator, you know, again, $300 trillion market, you have to allocate towards this, and you have bonds, which is the fixed income market, right? Now you have assets that are paying 10% and they're backed by Bitcoin. I think, yes, we're going to see Bitcoin gobble that up, at least start to suck a lot of the monetary premium off of that. Obviously not right away. I think you can see Larry Fink at BlackRock talking about they're already having their advisors start to recommend Bitcoin. We can see that a lot of fund managers are already starting to allocate to Bitcoin. And so, yeah, it's coming for the bond market. It's coming for the fixed income market. It's coming for the equity market. It's coming for all those markets.
It seems like, though, that, you know, maybe the big dogs like BlackRock and, you know, JP Morgan, they're just starting to roll out a lot of these products. So I get the general sense that a lot of the wealth advisors are not advising a lot of their clients to buy Bitcoin just yet. They're still being a little bit tentative. And it seems like, you know, the traditional financial world is a little bit more, I guess, cautionary. They're like kind of a wait and see approach. Do you kind of get that sense as well with like the ETFs and how this has been rolling out? And maybe the MicroStrategies of the world are the way that, you know, they've been able to dip their toe in, so to speak?
Yeah, of course. I think it all depends on what your time frame is, right? So we can see like Michael Saylor, for example, a lot of people are sort of, a lot of people think he doesn't know what he's doing. He's selling too much equity in the market, diluting the shares. He's suppressing the price. You know, he's an idiot. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's just playing a different game on a different time frame. So, you know, maybe he's playing a 10-year game, whereas other companies are just starting up and they're trying to get their stock going and they're playing a short-term game. And so I think back to sort of the question you asked about, where is general Wall Street allocators and even where is the public in this? They're coming. I think it just takes a lot longer than most people realize. So, for example, I was on the phone with my dad the other day, and he's like, why isn't Bitcoin's price going up with all these announcements of all these companies buying? And I said, it did. It did go up. It was in the 80,000 range just a few months ago. Mm-hmm. Now we're, you know, well over 100. That's a $20,000 move, right? It did go up. And I think because these big buys that we're seeing, these companies popping up, these were projected into the market a long time ago, mm-hmm. right? It takes a long time for public institutions to come around to change their mandates, to go make their buys. We're talking, you know, quarters. We're talking years for this to happen. And so the market has sort of front run a lot of that news. So I think number one, yes, it takes a lot longer than most people think. Because that news is sort of public, the market starts front running that. So you don't see that one-to-one move, number one. Number two, when we look at sort of the way technology always reaches adoption, we have the diffusion of innovation and it's sort of like this bell curve. And you have, it takes about 15% adoption to get past like the first stage. And then you have about another 10 to 15% adoption to sort of get to the early adopters. And then you have this chasm. And the chasm is what has to be crossed before kind of the early majority starts to get in. And that's where something has to shift. Typically, it's like a psychological shift in the market. And I think number one, there's like a generational gap, where like grandparents won't buy Bitcoin, grandkids will never buy gold sort of a thing. Mm-hmm. But then there's also the legitimate gap, right? So it's like seeing the governments get involved, seeing the ETFs come out, seeing your financial advisor start to recommend, it starts to make it more legitimate. But even then, it still takes time before you're willing to sort of make the move, put your money in and things like that. So I think I think it's just a time problem. Yes, it's happening slow to some in some regards, but I think for me, I talk about these 50-year cycles that we have. And so really we're only going into the phase two of this 50-year cycle. We're about, you know, 14 years into this, and everything seems to be happening right on cue of what we'd expect if you look at it from a longer lens.
Yeah, you definitely talk about a lot of these different cycles kind of converging, and I want to get into that. You know, you've talked about like the 80-year debt cycle, and then, you know, you've mentioned AI. It seems like it's this perfect cocktail to just make Bitcoin absolutely explode and take over potentially even quicker than that 50 years.
Yeah.
Now, I want to hear kind of like your opinion on all of these cycles essentially colliding and how you see this playing out.
Yeah.
The best place to buy Bitcoin in the United States and Canada is the Bitcoin Well. You could go to the bitcoinwell.com/greencandle and sign up today, and they will give you wishing well tokens. They are one of the only exchanges in the United States that will give you free sats every time you buy Bitcoin. You have a chance to win 1 million sats every time you buy. You get wishing well tokens. You flip the coin down the wishing well, and you have the chance to win 1 million sats. You heard me here, folks. 1 million sats. And on top of that, they have the absolute best over-the-counter service where you can make purchases over $50,000. And they will walk you through the whole thing. They have the best rates in the United States and in Canada. And on top of that, they have the best white glove service where they will take you through those giant purchases just so you feel comfortable. You'll get it in cold storage and it's strictly non-custodial. They are saying, we want you to experience the true power of Bitcoin and that self-custody. So go to the well, sign up, bitcoinwell.com/greencandle today.
Well, the 50-year cycle specifically is just like this technological revolution cycle that we have. And there's four distinct phases in there. And so phase one is sort of the technology is invented and you sort of have this eruption, this retail eruption. And so that's sort of where Bitcoin's been for the last 10 years, or I should say the first 10 years, right? And that really led to the explosion of Bitcoin and then altcoins. So we're still trying to experiment. We're still trying to do different things. Retail's coming in, small amounts of money. Phase two has always been about the institutional allocators coming in, and that's sort of what we're seeing right now. So I think it's playing out right on time. I would say 2030 is where really Bitcoin starts to be more of a medium of exchange and it started to be used more. And once we get past 2040, 2050, I'm forecasting Bitcoin will be a unit of account by then. Oh, by 2050.
Wow. Okay.
So that's one cycle. Now, it overlays with, as you said, two other big cycles that I track. Number one is this 80-year financial revolution cycle. And I mean, it's playing out right in front of us, right? 80 years ago was the Bretton Woods Agreement, which is when the entire world sort of reorganized and decided to, you know, peg to the dollar that ought to be backed by gold. And here we are now with, you know, Donald Trump coming in, Mar-a-Lago Accords, trying to reset global tariffs and trade. We have the IMF calling for a Bretton Woods II agreement, right? And so we can see that the financial system is starting to fall apart. The whole world, Trump, the IMF are calling for a reorganization of the financial world. So that's happening right now. And so while we're at this point where the financial system is failing, we're basically having a sovereign, you know, global bond crisis all over the world. And at the same time, we have where, you know, the U.S. Treasury market, which is the bedrock of the global financial system, has now been basically, you know, other nations have basically been warned, don't save all your money in there because we might take it from you, right? When Russia had their bank account seized after mm-hmm. they attacked Ukraine. And so we sort of have this whole world sort of trying to figure out what money is next at the same time as the technology cycle is bringing it right into fruition at the same time. So I think that's the big two that we're looking at right now. And so it's like the BRICS nations are talking about starting their own currency. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we had the BIS working with China to create this Project Enbridge, which is like a CBDC platform. So is it CBDCs? Is it some, you know, gold-backed currency? China's going to back it. You know, are the BRICS nations going to have their own currency? We know central banks are net sellers of treasuries and buyers of gold right now, buying more gold than any time in history. And so everybody's trying to figure out what next. And, you know, to the question you asked earlier, like, is it going to come for the bond market? Yes, it already is. Not quite the sovereign bond market yet, although we do see lots of sovereigns buying Bitcoin for their balance sheets. So it's all coming. It's all coming. Like I said, if you look at the long lens, it's all happening right on cue. For some people that don't really understand history, they think it's not happening fast enough.
Yeah, that is fair. I mean, just like you said, you know, your dad was calling up saying, why isn't the Bitcoin price moving? You're like, it did. I think that's what the message that I get all the time as well. It's like, you know, they're sending all this bullish news and everything like that. And it's like, well, you know, these publicly traded companies are announcing the buys after they already happened. There's not like, hey, I'm buying this much, and people are essentially going to front run that, right? So I think it's interesting that we're seeing this monetary, I guess, you know, facade kind of play out before our eyes. And, you know, what we're seeing, it seems like, is Trump and Powell almost at odds, right? I mean, Trump has been essentially coming out and saying he's going to fire Powell. He needs to lower these interest rates. And there's been a lot of back and forth regarding that. How do you see, I guess, the US dollar essentially playing out with all of this? Do you see it as we crash and burn, or is it kind of that gradual into potentially that Bitcoin standard?
Yeah, I think the dollar's death is overly exaggerated, in my opinion. I think it's more of a process and not an event. So the doomers, the gold salespeople will tell you there's this imminent event coming where the dollar's going to crash and you better get off now while you still can. But I think it's rather the dollar is crashing. It's been crashing. Right, Michael Saylor talks about his house in Miami was $100,000. Now it's $100 million. The dollar's crashed 97%. So it's happening. Mm-hmm. I remember a year ago, maybe it was 2 years ago, when inflation was really high. One of my friends called me up and he's like, "Mark, what's going on? I see in the news, and do I need to get all my money out of the bank?" And I was like, "Why?" He's like, "Well, I'm afraid that I could wake up and, you know, maybe it buys me half as much stuff." I said, "It already does, just in the last 5 years alone. That's already happened, right?" So it's not like there's this imminent event coming, like it's already happening. But I do think, I was at the Bitcoin conference, I did a panel with Lynn Alden and James Lavish, and we're talking about Triffin's dilemma. And so Triffin's dilemma is a situation where the United States, being the reserve currency of the world, is forced to print dollars and send them to the world and import goods and services and basically hollow out its middle class. And so we're sort of stuck in this situation. Most people think we're stuck in the situation where the U.S. continually has to print the dollars, continue to devalue it, and that'll crash the system. And it'll push inflation sky high. And the U.S. is going to go into hyperinflation like Weimar Republic of Germany and all these things. But I think Bitcoin sort of maybe is certainly it's a life raft for you and I. We can get off that ship right now, and we have. But I think it's also maybe a way to sort of help the rest of the system along, right? Because if you think about it, most people are still looking at like asset prices and like stock prices as in like, are they cheap or expensive? But like without understanding global liquidity, you can't really understand that, because as more liquidity comes into the system, it sort of rises all those prices, right? So, you know, in 2008, when the world was breaking down, the global financial system was crashing, they launched into QE, and most mainstream economists will tell you that there was no inflation because of that, because the money went to the banks, it didn't go to the public. Although home prices and stock prices went sky high, but that's not inflation. That's asset appreciation, right? Whatever. I think that's splitting hairs.
Yeah.
But the point is that when all that money was created, it pushed the price of homes and stocks and all those things up. And that's what happens as this Triffin's dilemma plays out. But Bitcoin is now like this liquidity sponge. And so as all that liquidity sort of rises up and starts pushing these asset prices higher, Bitcoin can sort of absorb all of that. And so maybe what we'll see is, you know, like I said, the real estate sort of not going up as fast as it used to, stocks not going up as fast as it used to, basically sucking the monetary premium out of those assets. And I think that could potentially save the system from this inflation. When I say save it, the system is broken. There is no saving it. Mm-hmm. Like it's just broken. A debt-based system doesn't work long term. But it could allow it to go on for a lot longer than most people think. And yeah, so I don't think it's imminent. I think it's a process. It's happening. The smart people are getting off the ship early. But yeah, I don't see an imminent crash, not in the next couple of decades anyway.
So do you think it's more important that it's almost kind of like taking away from some of these other markets, whether it's, you know, bonds, real estate, the stock market, or the potential of like the U.S. almost using a Bitcoin strategic reserve to help strengthen our economy, potentially do the sovereign wealth fund, kind of help our own government be a little bit more self-sufficient and, you know, maybe get out of that debt spiral that we're in? Which one of those two do you think is more important, I guess, for the slower transition?
Well, I think it's number one, right? Because like I'm saying, like most people are priced out of the housing market. Mm-hmm. Homes are too expensive. Stocks are too expensive. Back in the day, Warren Buffett said, I don't buy stocks, I buy companies. They just happen to be publicly traded. But today, people don't buy companies, they're just trading stocks. Mm-hmm. And so now the stock market has this massive premium on top of it. Homes have this massive premium. You have all this money. Where do you park it? Well, I guess I'll go buy a bunch of homes, right? And so what I'm saying is I think Bitcoin can sort of absorb that monetary premium, allow home prices, asset prices in general to sort of not go up as fast as they were before, which then makes it more affordable for like my kids and my grandkids coming up, number one. Number two, I think each one of us should also be moving over to a Bitcoin standard, because on a Bitcoin standard, we can see that everything priced in Bitcoin gets cheaper, mm-hmm. right? So homes get cheaper, et cetera. Now, as far as the government goes, I might have a little bit of a contrarian take on that. Obviously, there's a bill, Senator Lummis floated a bill to have a strategic Bitcoin reserve. And she talks about buying Bitcoin and then being able to pay off the national debt with that. Now, we started the conversation talking about the wealthy people don't sell assets, mm-hmm. they lever it with debt. And so the first question I would ask is, why would we ever want to pay that off? Imagine that we have an asset like Bitcoin, and imagine that asset goes up so much that we can afford to pay off the national debt. Why would we sell that? Like that asset just went up that much and now we're going to sell it? Right? And again, sort of back to if the asset is going up faster than the rate of debt. So as long as the asset is going up by more than the whatever the rates will be at that time, 2%, 4%, 5%, it would make sense to keep the asset and not sell it. So I think, sure, the government should have a strategic reserve. I think what it does is it instills confidence in the U.S., just like we have an industrial base, just like we have a military, just like we have gold. And so it keeps confidence in the U.S. dollars, the government's ability to pay back its bonds and keep that market functioning. But I would hope we wouldn't pay off the debt and sell the Bitcoin.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so as well. But I mean, maybe we get, you know, one of these new financial-based products loaning against the Bitcoin. Maybe there's some way we could do that, but without having to completely sell the Bitcoin. But you said something interesting about, you know, the monetary premium that's on stocks. There's always people on Twitter and everything talking about the decoupling. How quickly do you think we get to that, where Bitcoin is then decoupled from like the S&P 500? Because it seems like it follows that pretty quickly, and then also follows the global M2 money supply pretty closely.
Yeah, but those are two different things, right? So what happens is, let's start with the money supply.
Okay.
So I was talking about the global liquidity. So what happens is the money gets printed.
Mm-hmm.
Banks create the money through the debt issuance, right? Where does it go? Well, okay, Mike, go to, well, you buy a car, and so then you give it to the guy to buy the car, but then where does he go? It goes to the suppliers, and where do they go? Well, they go buy their food, and eventually it goes to someone who saves it,
mm-hmm.
right? Where do they save it? Well, they're going to save it in store value assets and gold and equities and bonds, et cetera, right? So basically, as that money supply grows, the global liquidity, the global M2 supply, then the asset prices go up with it. Now, what happens is that money moves like through a straw, through a pipe from the least risky assets to the most risky assets. So it's going to go first into credit markets, right? And then it's going to work its way into stocks. And then it's going to work its way out into risk assets. And it's going to work its way all the way out into like emerging markets and things like that. And as liquidity goes down, then that like a straw starts coming back. And so it's like how much gets pushed all the way out to the end of that risk curve is what we're talking about. So when you're talking about the global M2 supply is sort of the leading indicator of that. When you talk about S&P 500 and Bitcoin being correlated, it's in that pipe. Bitcoin is a little bit further out. So it's going to go up and it's also going to come down sort of together. Now, the risk assets are more sensitive to that. So if you look at the S&P 500, it overlays almost perfectly with the global monetary supply, with the global M2. Whereas Bitcoin has a sensitivity of, I believe, 8.9 times. So it's moving up faster. So if you overlay a chart of Bitcoin in the S&P 500, it's correlated about 80%, I believe. Mm-hmm. It's when it's not correlated that it matters. So I guess what I'm saying is if liquidity goes up or down, asset prices go up and down. Some assets go up and down faster than others. And so that's the correlated, uncorrelated part. I don't see it like stocks go down so Bitcoin goes up. I don't see it working in an inverse relation like that. It's always going to move up and down with liquidity.
Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense. And yeah, I mean, I feel like that's the way it's always going to go, right? I mean, Bitcoin's the most liquid asset on the planet, liquid market on the planet. So the more liquidity, I feel like, is just always going to go towards Bitcoin. But we talked about governments just briefly right before this, and I kind of want to dive back into that, the current state of everything, right? We've got the trade wars going on. How do you view the overall economy right now? Because I feel like there's a lot of just, you know, differences of opinion right now. Some think it's great, inflation's done. Some think it's not, you know, inflation's not under wraps, we need to keep interest rates higher. Yeah. Where do you think we're at?
Well, I would say generally, I think that we are about to go into the greatest era of prosperity the world's ever seen. That being said, maybe not for everybody. So we've certainly seen 2020 exaggerated this sort of K-shaped recovery. And so you sort of have the people at the top and the people at the bottom, and that gap is getting wider. So if you go and look at like luxury brands, they're selling, you know, at all-time high still. I was just looking at a chart yesterday of like retailers like Nordstrom, so high-end retailers, and their margins are turning up pretty fast right now. So we can see that's working pretty well. The problem for the bottom part of the economy is that inflation has still been hitting them pretty hard. So I think the economy is doing good. When we look at it, like, unemployment's still very low, so everyone's working. Real wages have been going up for like the last 4 years, so that's been helping a little bit, right? Inflation's come back down, wages are going back up, so that's good. Credit expansion is still happening at a pretty rapid clip. That means people are pretty optimistic about the future. So I think there's a lot of places that we can look at to say the economy is still doing really good. You know, what Trump is trying to do, part with tariffs, with part trying to bring some manufacturing back. I've been calling it Make America Investable Again. So by doing this beautiful big tax bill, bringing bonus depreciation back, bringing these tax cuts back, he's trying to bring a lot of manufacturing back. We had $5 trillion of commitments to bring new manufacturing back to the United States, fast-tracking permits, fast-tracking energy, things like that. That's a lot of job growth. That's a lot of just growth overall in the U.S. And I think most people aren't really prepared for that. I think most people were so hammered by the mainstream media that tariffs were going to wreck the world. Nobody would ever do business with the United States again. Somehow all the world was going to sell products without bringing the U.S. in. Somehow that was supposed to happen. And I think, you know, everyone says, oh, he caved, Trump caved. It's like, that was always sort of the art of the deal. You anchor really high and then you settle back lower. I think the deal with China is pretty much solved. Obviously, the markets have been responding to that. And I think the job growth and the GDP growth is going to be a lot higher than most people are ready for. That being said, back to the question about inflation. The question of inflation is a different story. Now, first of all, it's kind of a pointless argument or even discussion to have. Saylor talks about this quite often, but if you go back to, you know, pre-1950, inflation was about the money supply, not the prices of things. Ludwig von Mises, the father of the Austrian School of Economics, I think it was like around 1952, he was on TV saying, hey, look, they're trying to change the definition. We can't change the definition of this, like warning us. And I think what he was saying is the reason why they want to change the definition is because if they change the definition of inflation from the money supply expansion or contraction to the prices of goods going up, then we lose all relation to it. So we don't understand it properly. Well, why did the price of that go up but the price of that went down? Well, it can't be because of the money supply, right? And so now the people are sort of confused. So I think, Rothbard said, right, that inflation is always a monetary phenomenon, right? So when they create more money, the prices of things go up and down, but not always at the same time. So I expect inflation overall as far as money supply to go up. I expect inflation as in prices of goods to go up as well. Of course, some will still go down, right? AI is deflating prices super rapidly. But I think overall the economy is going to do good. I expect a lot of growth to happen. I expect a lot of liquidity to come into the market, and I see a lot of asset appreciation.
Man, so that's sounds like a good next, at least the next few years here, right? So, you know, you're talking about the opposite of what the mainstream media is talking about, right? They're saying, you know, everything's doom and gloom. Trump's doing these tariffs. It seems like they're sounding the alarm bells. Why do you think that they're, you know, putting so much focus on these tariffs, like it's going to be, you know, a huge negative towards that?
Okay, so you've discovered Bitcoin and are on the path to financial self-sovereignty. But simply holding Bitcoin is not enough. You need to make sure that it's stored properly and you are in 100% control over all your assets. So sharing your keys with third parties and taking on that counterparty risk is not the answer. The answer is pure and simple. It's uncompromising self-custody, and there's no better way to do it than the Bitcoin way. They've got over 25 years of cybersecurity experience, and their team of experts can help you properly self-custody your Bitcoin, secure your digital life, configure your privacy phones, and even establish a Plan B residency if you're looking to do so. So I'm gonna help you guys out here and give you a free consultation if you take the first step and visit thebitcoinway.com/greencandle, and you can check out the boys at The Bitcoin Way and see how they can help you become self-sovereign.
Unfortunately, politics is very divided in the world, not just in America, in the world. So I think there's a lot of people who definitely wanted Trump to fail and will do anything to sort of influence that, you know, failure. I think that's number one. I think number two, we have a lot of pseudoscience out there, right? So we have a lot of wannabe economics, you know, who don't really understand how this whole system works, right? So take something like tariffs, for example, right? So there's a lot of historical ways that we can look at this, maybe even just going back to his first term. So he first started increasing tariffs in his first term. One of the first things he raised tariffs on was steel. He raised tariffs on washing machines. But we saw the prices of those things come down after he did that. And we don't have to go back that far to see that, mm-hmm. right? I think there's a bigger misunderstanding of what tariffs even are, how they work. So for example, if the consumer was going to be paying higher prices, right? That was how media sold it to us, that it's a tax on everybody. They're going to be paying higher prices. Then why was the rest of the world so mad about it if Americans were going to pay for it?
Yeah, doesn't add up.
Yeah. Well, let's think about this, right? So if we're going to import a product into the United States, who pays the tariff? The importer. The importer pays the tariffs. Now, the way a capitalist system works is that in an efficient market, you don't have these exorbitant profit margins. Otherwise, someone would come eat those profit margins. So the importer has to pay those tariffs, and they pay them to the government. Okay, well, they can't afford that. Obviously, they're running on thin margins. So then what are they going to do? Well, they can push it to the producer, back to the manufacturer, the one who's the most upset about it, and they can push it down their entire chain. Or they could push it to the retailer, to Walmart. But do you think if Walmart could raise their prices, they probably would? Probably. But they can't. Why? Because then Target would outcompete them, or then Amazon would outcompete them, right? So it's like, where does that get made up? It can't go to the retailer. If the retailers could, they already would. So then the importer's going to have to eat a little bit. Most of it's going to get pushed backwards down the supply chain, which is why all the other nations were so mad about it. Maybe a little bit does come to the consumer, right? And so I think there's just a big misunderstanding of how that works. And then I think also there's the bigger piece of this, which is that what happens when we can produce goods at home, right? And what does that do for the overall all economy? So if we create more higher paying jobs and everybody makes more money, is it better to absorb a couple points on a price increase? So I think there's just, it's a big topic. It's sort of like, on the last election, I was thinking, right, one of the number one topics for the last election, presidential election, was inflation. Everybody was getting hammered by inflation. Mm-hmm. But most people don't understand inflation. I live on the ocean. I've often thought that maybe I should learn how to sail a boat. I don't know how to sail a boat. I would imagine if I wanted to sail a boat across the ocean, it could be pretty dangerous. Like I could run into a storm. It could be 50, 60 foot waves. Like what happens if, you know, something were to happen, whatever, right? So I don't know anything about sailing. So let's say, do you know anything about sailing?
No, idea.
Okay. So let's say that we had to vote for a captain of a boat to sail us across the ocean, but neither of us know anything about sailing. How are we going to vote for a captain?
Yeah, that's a good question.
This would be a popularity contest, mm-hmm. right? He's going to promise me I'm my own stateroom. He's going to promise you your own steak every night, whatever, right? And that's sort of like the issues that we live in today, right? Like nobody understands inflation. The presidents, right, don't even understand inflation. So how are we all voting on this situation? I'd say that's what it comes down to, just an education gap.
Yeah, and I mean, that makes a lot of sense. I feel like, you know, like you said, inflation was the number one topic, and everybody was asking, hammering left and right about inflation. But another interesting aspect that I think is kind of, you know, revolutionizing before our eyes, you've talked about a little bit briefly, is AI. How do you see this kind of coming in with efficiency, you know, potentially adding more higher paying jobs, just business wise? How do you see AI playing this role in the new economy and, you know, in conjunction with Bitcoin?
Yeah. So again, that's sort of what I'm going to be talking about here. AI with this infinite efficiency. And then how does Bitcoin fit in with absolute scarcity? So there's two contrasting forces. But again, going back through history, we've had sixth technological revolution in the last 300 years. And each one follows this dependable pattern. And every single time, it was going to take everybody's jobs and the world was going to end. So we had back before the Industrial Revolution, we had basically just the textile industry. We had farmers and textiles. And there was somebody that created a power loom. And the power loom was going to allow us to, you know, put the tapestries together faster. And there was a group called the Luddites. And they were afraid that it was going to take everybody's jobs. And they went and burned these looms down, right? And we've had that ever since. Right. So the candle makers were afraid of electricity putting them out of work, and the buggy makers were afraid of the cars putting them out of work and all those things. And the fact is they did get put out of work, right? When the Industrial Revolution, all of a sudden we had mechanized machines that could do the work of 5,000 men. But what do those 5,000 men go do? Well, turns out they go do things like science and medicine, like higher value things. So technology is supposed to take away lower level tasks so we can go work on higher level tasks. And every technological revolution has been the exact same story that's going to take away all the jobs, but every single one has created more jobs than it's taken. Different jobs, new jobs, higher value jobs. Computers were going to take away all the jobs, but now we have all these jobs around computers. What it does do is it does create a disruption, though. So the 5,000 men were replaced by machines. Now we have 5,000 people out of work. So there is a disruption, and that's a problem. And we can see probably the last time we really saw this happen was in like 1989. China was introduced into the World Trade Organization. The internet came on. China came on as the as a trading partner, and it really sucked a lot of jobs out of the United States. And so we can see in those disruptions, I mean, yeah, unemployment can rise. Again, back to that sort of K-shaped recovery. A lot of the people that just depend on sort of probably the first one are going to be more like customer service type jobs, programming jobs, content creation jobs. A lot of those people will be displaced. But, you know, so that's bad for them. There will be new jobs created for them. From the economy side, from like the business side, from the investing market side, you know, what happens when these companies that are people are investing into, what happens when their profitability goes up by 20 or 30%? Or 50%. Well, their stock becomes more valuable. My investment portfolio goes up, right? My retirement savings goes up. So I think we have to understand that these situations are not black and white. They're good and bad at the same time. It depends on what lens I'm looking at them from. So if I'm a retiree, I'm stoked. My prices are going up. If my job gets lost, maybe I'm bummed. I can learn a new job or whatever. But I think overall, if we look out a little bit longer, we look out a decade, two decades from now, back to, I think this is going to be the greatest era of prosperity we've ever seen. I think, you know, on one hand, we have the ability now to have single person businesses that can make millions of dollars. You know, we didn't have that before. And so what we really want ultimately is efficiency. That's what we really want, right? Mm-hmm. Instead of carrying 10 bricks across the yard one at a time, I create a wheelbarrow and I create 10 bricks, I carry 10 bricks at one time. And that's what AI is doing. So from an investor standpoint, from a market standpoint, I think it's going to be really good.
Yeah. So it sounds like, you know, almost new businesses need to have some sort of AI strategy. Is that kind of
looking
at? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I feel like with Bitcoin and AI now, that's changing the way businesses are being run and even being started. You've been a very successful entrepreneur. So if you had to start again today, what is something that you would make sure that you prioritized early on to, you know, build any type of business?
Yeah. So one thing, I mean, we're using it aggressively in my businesses. And what I'm thinking from my venture capital lens, companies that we're invested into, I was meeting with one of them today, actually, and explaining to them, like, you need to be able to go to market faster. Like, with AI that we have today, we have no-code tools. Like, you should be able to get a prototype up and running, and we should be able to get this into the market and start validating it. Two things. Number one, before you start to try to raise too much capital, we need to know, number one, does the market even validate this idea? And then number two, are you able to sell it? And I think AI allows us to do those types of things really quickly. So I would say from that lens, I would try to spin up a prototype as quickly as possible, validate the idea if I'm a new business, mm-hmm. right? So validate the idea, spin up a product, MVP, like a minimum viable product, and get that to market and test it. That'd be number one. Number two, I mean, we should be trying to use it in every area of our business. I think a lot of business owners look at it sort of the wrong way, though. And so rather than trying to have it do work for people, we should be looking at it as thinking partners, right? So can it help me strategize my tax plan or my legal plan? Can it help me with market research, competitor research? Can it help me identify weaknesses in my own business that we can do? So there's a few ways that I think small business owners should be doing it, but 100%, if you're not adopting it right now, you're going to be left behind. I tell everybody on my team, as a matter of fact, like, either you learn how to use these tools or you're going to be replaced by them, and I don't want that to happen. I don't look at it as like mass layoffs will happen, because businesses want to grow. Mm-hmm. So that's like, I'm not telling my team I'm going to get rid of you and replace you with AI. I'm telling them to learn AI so we can do more than we're doing now. And so I think that's kind of how I think about it from an abundance mindset. But yeah, get with it or get left behind.
Self-custody can be a daunting task. That's why I've partnered with Bitbox. They have the best hardware wallet. They make it the easiest to put Bitcoin in self-custody. So go to bitbox.swiss/greencandle today and use promo code greencandle and you can get 5% off your entire order. They make it so easy, all in one. You could get the hardware wallet, you could get their punch plates, you could do it all right there on that website to make the self-custody experience the easiest it can be. So visit bitbox.swiss/greencandle, use promo code greencandle, get 5% off your entire order, and get your Bitcoin off an exchange into self-custody today. All right, enough for me. Let's get back to the show.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, I use AI almost every day to try to, you know, help with the YouTube titles, all these different kind of things. But yeah, if you just take it at surface level and just say, hey, spit out a YouTube title for this video, it's usually not very good, right? So it's still kind of like a learning process, I think. And like utilizing AI in conjunction with, you know, human element of it, I think is, you know, increasing efficiency drastically. So, you know, on top of AI, what about the risk of having Bitcoin on a new business? Because obviously there's volatility with Bitcoin. There's seemingly less volatility than there was maybe 5-10 years ago. But, you know, Bitcoin on the balance sheet is the new phase here, at least for publicly traded companies. How do you view that for like a new startup or maybe a company that you're investing in?
Yeah, I think the company I was meeting with earlier today, like I was mentioning, they have 70% of their balance sheet in Bitcoin. And because we've been in a pretty good bull market for Bitcoin, it's extended their runway. Mm-hmm. That's great. If Bitcoin had gone down, it'd be the opposite. Mm-hmm. So the problem is with anybody, you and I, individuals, businesses, putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet is, are you able to weather that storm, right? We understand that Bitcoin is volatile. And so I wouldn't want to put short-term money into that, right? The treasury companies are something different, right? So they're leveraging public and debt markets, equity markets, to get Bitcoin to put away. But for spending money, you need to have access to cash, right? So I think it just comes down to time frame. If I'm a small business owner, I'm doing, you know, a couple hundred grand, a couple hundred thousand, I mean, even millions, I'm going to look at like how much cash do I need to keep on hand based off of, typically for small business, it's like a 13-week cash flow report for the next 13 weeks. How much revenue are we bringing in? And then try to find that amount that I want to keep in there, understanding that whatever I'm going to put into Bitcoin is going to be long-term money, right? So for my own business, we keep about 6 months of working capital in cash. You know, obviously we're still making money, but then quarterly we can decide, okay, how much do we want to put away into cold storage, right? Mm-hmm. And that's sort of how we do it. But I would say that for a business thinking about allocating to Bitcoin for their treasury, it's really only long-term money.
Okay.
And when I say long-term money, I'm thinking years. You know, typically what I say is take whatever money you can afford to set aside for 5 years and just put that into Bitcoin.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Now, do you think that this is all kind of playing into your thesis that we're going to be in this economic boom, the biggest one that we've ever seen in history, just kind of, you know, this era of prosperity, like the combination of AI with a massive amounts of efficiency and Bitcoin potentially just, you know, making things explode here?
That and the massive amount of money printing that's going to happen over the next 5 years. So as demographics continue to fall off and unemployment rises, Long term, like I said, I'm not afraid of the doom and gloom of AI replacing everybody's job. But in the short term, there is disruption. So you take those factors into consideration with the sovereign debt bubble that we have going on. And so we have a massive amount of money printing at the same time as we have the growth coming in GDP from AI. And I think it's those two factors combining together that are going to push things up way faster and higher than most people are prepared for.
So do you think that that big print that Lawrence Lepard has written about, you think that's coming sooner than people think?
I mean, not in the way. Lawrence is my partner at the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund. So I love Lawrence. He's super smart. Not in the way that he describes it necessarily. You know, in the book, he's talking about this massive crash that then forces them to go print more money than we've ever seen before. That's, you know, sort of like we saw in 2020, you know, $11 trillion or whatever it was, or 2008. So maybe not the one event, but more of the process like I talked about earlier. Mm-hmm. So I think it's this continued process of having to print into the face of, like I said, these factors of the sovereign debt crisis that we have, decline in demographics, and probably unemployment rising at the same time. And so this relentless raising of money in that environment, I think, is going to push asset prices very high.
So then I got to ask then, how high do you think we're going with Bitcoin?
So I have a whole talk on my channel breaking down the math of how we get there. For us, luckily in the United States, the government, the CBO, Congressional Budget Office, projects out where deficit spending debt will be through 2034 for the next 30 years. And so if you understand that as that money supply gets bigger, asset prices go up, we can look back on how that's affected asset prices over the last, you know, whatever, 20 years. We can see that, for example, in 2010, the store value assets were about $300 trillion by 2010. By 2020, they're about $900 trillion. Today, they're about $1,000 trillion. And I project that by 2030 to be $1.4 quadrillion, by 2040 to be $3.5 quadrillion. Then the question is, what percentage of that basket does Bitcoin absorb? I'm projecting $1 million by 2030, 14 million by 2040, and 40 million by 2050. And to put that into some mathematical terms, that would be, again, the store value assets getting to be about 3.5 quadrillion by 2040, and Bitcoin capturing only 8% of that basket. To put that into some relation, what happens like from a Bitcoin venture, from a venture frame, we'd say like, hey, Uber, what is it? Well, it's going to disrupt taxis and limos. Okay, how big is that addressable market, the TAM? What percentage can we capture of that market? And Uber and Airbnb both captured 10% of their markets in less than 10 years. So it's pretty realistic. Mm-hmm. So to think that Bitcoin could get to 8% by 2040 seems pretty conservative.
Yeah, that does seem pretty conservative. Is there anything that would make you increase that, like maybe shift that timeline a little bit sooner?
I mean, sure, there's lots of things that could shift that time frame. I think, you know, Michael Saylor gives like a bear case, a medium case, and a bull case. I guess I could give like three cases there. But what I was doing based off that mathematical formula is just looking at how fast Bitcoin has been growing. So we're looking at not only how fast is the basket growing that it needs to disrupt, but then within that basket, how fast are each of the other assets growing and at what ratios, and then sort of projecting that forward. What would happen that could cause that to go faster? Obviously, we could have a lot faster adoption than what we've had in the past. So I think that could change something dramatically. I think the amount of money supply expansion is pretty much guaranteed. And like I said, the CBO projects that out for us. If anything, I think they're going to way undershoot that. I'm sure it's going to be way more. So I think we could get way more money printing than we're expecting, which could then push that basket way bigger and Bitcoin can go a lot higher. The adoption can go a lot faster. There's a lot of things that could happen. But yeah, that's my numbers.
All right. And then with the governments kind of starting to adopt it and, you know, governments globally talking about it, we've actually had the Czech National Bank. We're here in Prague potentially talking about putting Bitcoin on the balance sheet.
Wow.
How they're going to do, you know, they're essentially doing some research behind it. And, you know, who knows if they'll actually end up doing it. But what do you make of the other potential El Salvador's, United States, all of these countries putting Bitcoin as a either reserve asset or sovereign wealth fund, and, you know, moving into not only, you know, we've got corporate adoption, ETFs, but also the government adoption?
Yeah, when El Salvador first announced they were going into, you know, announcing Bitcoin as a a reserve. No, what did they? Oh, legal tender. Sorry. Mm-hmm. So yeah. So when El Salvador first announced that Bitcoin would be a legal tender, it was pretty big news. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a country. It's a nation. Although El Salvador is one of the poorest nations in the world, so they're not really a big influential nation, right? But it's a start. And you sort of think of like Bitcoin sort of having this decentralized path of starting from the ground up of individuals and then working its way to governments. And then it starts with the small governments and eventually goes to the big governments. That's how I saw it. I think most people sort of saw that game theory playing out. And of course, and like I said, they're not that big of an influential country, but they're, you know, President Bukele was meeting with dozens of other countries, smaller other countries. Mm-hmm. But when the United States decided to announce it, it was pretty surprising to me, right? I always thought that the U.S. would probably be the last country to come around because they had the most to lose, right, with the reserve currency of the world. And I think it's important to kind of understand it from that frame because if the United States, which had the most to lose, had the reserve currency of the world, was coming around to adopt it, then they are the single most influential country in the world, not like El Salvador. Now it's from mm-hmm. the top down. And I think at this point, you know, we're just seeing other countries just announce it almost every day. If the United States is going to do it, then why wouldn't they? And so I think maybe kind of going back to the previous question you asked about what would change things to maybe make it move up even faster, potentially seeing other nations adopt it even faster. Just because when nations adopt an asset like that, like number one, the buys are big, mm-hmm. Right? And we already know we have a very tight supply. Number two, they're not really price conscious. They're not hedge funds trying to trade around it. They're mm-hmm. just buying it no matter what. And so I think that could certainly change it. I think seeing the U.S. Move into Bitcoin is giving all these other nations the confidence they need to do that. And again, we started this sort of at the beginning talking about how is Bitcoin sort of moving too slowly? To look at nations buying it today, I'd say it's not moving too slowly. But also even this process is going to take years to mm-hmm. play out.
Yeah, I definitely think that this is, you know, the start of something very big, right? I mean, we're having the institutional adoption. I think government adoption is just going to take more time just by nature, right? These governments move a little bit slower. But we're here in Prague. What is something that you're looking forward to this week? And maybe as you're traveling coming here, I know you said you had a long day of travel before we got here.
Yeah. Yeah. It's my first time in Prague. I'm excited to be here. I've heard about this conference for many years, heard it's amazing. So I'm excited to be here. Let's see, a couple things I'm excited about. Number one, there's a big developer day. So I love coming and seeing what's being built on Bitcoin. Talking about the number going up is fun, but I love seeing what's being developed on Bitcoin. So I'm happy to check that out. I got a couple big talks, excited to give those. Happy to learn more and see what's going on with the Bitcoin treasury companies. Coming from Bitcoin conference in Vegas a few weeks ago, man, the excitement and energy in the air was just so high because there's so much new stuff going on. So excited to see that. And then I'm going to take a couple days with my wife. She's flying out here, and we're going to go check out Budapest.
Oh, nice.
So I figured I'm over here. Might as well go check out a couple things. I have such a long trip back home. Might as well go extend that a little bit.
Yeah. One thing I've always noticed about you too, Mark, is you've got some great style. I don't know if we got this in the camera, but you got these great Nike shoes. Yeah. I got to ask, how many shoes do you have in the closet there? Are you a big sneakerhead?
I'm not a big sneakerhead. You know, my closet's kind of small, unfortunately, but you know, when you're standing on stage, you got to have the right kicks, right?
Yeah, so, exactly. You got to be fresh.
Yeah, I typically have like a new pair of kicks before I go on stage.
There we go. I like it. All right. Well, I'm looking forward to seeing your talks, and thank you so much for coming here and doing this podcast with me. Where can people find out more about you and maybe even the Bitcoin Opportunity Fund and all the stuff you got going on?
Yeah, so Twitter, onemarkmoss.com, mostly on YouTube, right? We hit 700,000 subscribers on YouTube.
There you go. Congrats.
Yeah, doing millions and millions of views on long form videos there. So check that out on YouTube. And yeah, Bitcoin Opportunity Fund, we're investing into Bitcoin companies that are building on and around the Bitcoin ecosystem. I had a publicly traded Bitcoin treasury play here, Matador, that we're working on. So check those out as well.
Nice. All right. Well, be sure to do all that. And thank you so much.
Thank you for tuning into the latest episode of the State of Bitcoin podcast. If you really enjoyed this one, I've got another one cooking up for you. You can click that right here and you can go to the next episode, which is an absolute banger where you know I'm bringing you only the latest and greatest guests. Or if you're looking for more macro related content, you could check out my other channel, Macro Insights Pod. I got it linked for you right here. So where I'm bringing you more about stocks, real estate, traditional finance stuff. So go ahead and check that out. And if you enjoyed this podcast, go ahead and hit that like, hit that subscribe button, and tell a friend to tell a friend. All right, enough from me. I'll see you at the next one.